Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Robin Lee, who has a fascinating project. And we were just chatting before the show that you got to assimilate to the U.S. through the eyes of Jackson Pollock. At least your palate did. A really cool book called Dinner with Jackson Pollock. But before we get to that artist's point of view, I want to talk about you as an artist, because you are from Melbourne, Australia. Spent time in Milan, now situated in the lovely Westchester. But you've been a photographer, a writer, director for the last two decades. How has that artistic journey brought you here to the U.S. and then out into East Hampton?
Wow. I suppose from a young age, I was always interested in, you know, the creative arts. It was not a question of what would be my job, but what creative area I would specialize in. I was lucky enough to be exposed to, you know, great artists in my midst and had a very strong art program at school. So I really was able to try lots of different things and, you know, crafts, ceramics, metalwork, woodwork, photography, graphic design, painting, and really kind of explore all of those things in a meaningful way from a young age. So Milan was my first stop when I was an 18-year-old. I went there as an assistant to a photographer. A friend from school had told me that his aunt was a famous photographer in Milan. And that just seemed like the ultimate to me.
Yeah. I mean, at that age, the allure of travel, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I was 15 when I decided to become a photographer. All I did was just tell my friends about how one day I was going to be this famous photographer, which probably bored them to tears. But ultimately, this friend coughed up this story about his aunt. And I said, I have to meet this aunt. Like, how can I meet her? And ultimately, I did meet her. And I started writing to her, begging her to be her assistant. And after my first year of university in Melbourne, she actually said, listen, my assistant's leaving in 2 months. If you really want to do this, you've got to be here in 2 months. And so I basically got permission to leave university. I begged my parents for the airfare and I got on a plane. And that was the beginning of this crazy journey, a culinary journey, a journey as a photographer, learning my way, on many levels. And culturally, Milan was a closed shop for me. It took many years to really get into the life there, but I found some true soul friends, and that really helped me along the way.
Well, I mean, being a teenager, leaving Australia, what did you take with you as far as recipes or foods? Because, you know, immersing yourself into Milan, that's a completely different culture. Did you bring a little of your homeland with you?
I feel like I was sort of at that time quite sort of immature in my thinking, and perhaps I still am now, but I kind of was going through a phase of almost rejecting what I had grown up with and really feeling that Europe was going to give me everything in every possible way, culturally, culinary, creatively. And so what I bought from home, I suppose, was my work ethic. You know, I grew up in a family where it was very important to apply yourself to whatever area you decided to follow. And that served me well in Milan because they work extremely hard. And I ended up living with some Italians, sort of learning the language through them, as well as the sort of the culinary heritage of that area, which was a beautiful experience.
Veal shank, osso buco. I know that
exactly.
Is, you know, common up there. What are some of the other dishes that you got to learn?
Well, listen, I'm obsessed with risotto milanese there, which I had the very first time in Rome, actually. But, my friend Concetta would cook Sicilian specialties and actually southern specialties. Her parents were bakers, and she grew up in their bakery. So she would come with, you know, the fennel biscotti, and, you know, we'd have them with Vinsanto after dinner. You know, her boyfriend was from Sardinia, and he would, you know, break out with the liqueurs after dinner too, but all the specialties from his little tiny town in Sardinia. So it, for me, they taught me everything, and they wouldn't allow me to really help them in the kitchen except for if I was just doing very basic tasks, because they took it so seriously. It was like a religion.
Yeah, I know every Christmas, I think panettone's from Milan.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, when that comes in, just the packaging alone, yeah. I'm always smitten with how over the top and how ornate it is. But everyone is almost secretive. It's proprietary about how they put their panettone together.
Absolutely. You try and get the recipe from Colva in Milan for their panettone. Like, you'd have to kill about five people. It's just not, that's not possible.
No. I love those guarded secrets, though. Which leads us to Jackson Pollock. I mean, you yourself had actually produced a book in Milan about your year of living there, discovering the food fashion and, you know, having a family in what you call a private city. Mm. Then you come to the U.S. to really kind of unearth a very private man. I mean, Jackson Pollock was obviously well known around the world as an artist, but his sensitivity and culinary side, I mean, wasn't even apparent when you first started this project. Why this leap into someone else's life?
Well, it was a leap that almost happened to me, in a sense. I didn't choose it. I went out to Pollock House really out of desperation. When we arrived as a family 4 years ago, I basically left behind 25 years of my career to restart in New York. So I arrived here. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have any clients. I didn't have any creative projects on here. I knew, you know, like a handful of people, and it was a huge shock to my system. And I needed a project, and I needed to be stimulated and excited and not just concentrating on visas and paperwork and settling my children into school, but to replenish myself and feel like I was refueling. That's what took me out to Pollock House in the first place. And from there, I just started getting more and more involved in the details of the place and like what the clues were and what the clues of the, you know, these inanimate objects were giving me. And in the pantry, shooting in the pantry, the pots and pans, spoons, you know, to me there were all these like, I don't know, there was like these bits of history that I just wished I had have known what it was like to be there at a dinner party. Who did the talking? Who did they invite? What was the dynamic like between them and their artist friends? Who cooked? Who didn't cook? Who was rude? You know, who was funny? Who was obscene? You know, I wanted all of that information, but I couldn't get it. But the questions led me to ask the question of the director of the Pollock Center, Helen Harrison. I said, oh, you know, are there any recipe books where I could look through and maybe there's blots on a page or, you know, markings, drawings, notes that I could deduct that perhaps that's what they ate? And she said, actually, we've got some handwritten recipes by Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner. And I was just like, you know, astounded. And I said, by Jackson Pollock? And she said, yes. And I said, gosh, could I see them? And she sent them to me. There were 16. And she sent me some scans. And looking at the scans, I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be beautiful to maybe photograph these in their glory, you know, the folds of the paper and the, you know, really getting the feel for that handwriting. So I came down there with my producer and photographed them and then looked through their recipe books. And that's where we discovered these other countless dozens of recipes stuffed in the backs and fronts of these books.
It's amazing. You know, in my head, obviously, the painter that he and both Lee were, with their abstract impressionism, drips of paint everywhere, splattering about. I thought that maybe there'd be recipes scribbled on the back. But no, it seemed like a lot of it was from RXs, prescriptions, doctor's notes. Mm. I mean, of all things.
I suppose when you hear or enjoy a good recipe, you just pick up whatever piece of paper you have available. I mean, I feel like I do that now. Like you're at a dinner party. Oh, can I just quickly write this down before I leave? I loved it so much. And you pull something out of your bag, you write on an envelope, you write on, you know, as you said, a prescription, one of Jackson's doctors who was assisting him or trying to assist him with his alcoholism. And, you know, there's a fantastic clam recipe on the back of this prescription, and on the other side is a great recipe for mussels. So, It's like whatever was available. But these things tell us, they give us hints and clues about someone's life. And I feel like one of the beautiful aspects of the project was really diving in with some depth into each recipe, literally, you know, absorbing it physically and trying it, but also really trying to understand what each recipe meant in the context of their lives as artists, in the culinary history of America, and all of these things. So it was a great learning journey and an enormous privilege for me.
I mean, Jackson Pollock is a man who didn't try spaghetti till he was 18. For being what, you know, I would assume is worldly, it just seems so odd that his, you know, life was so closed to begin with.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's interesting. I would say that his mother was one of the most sort of impressive, industrious and dynamic women that I could possibly imagine, and that she chose not to serve Italian food in her repertoire is interesting, because her own handwritten recipe book shows the breadth and passion of her as an artist in the kitchen, and she brought a lot of that to the family table. You know, she'd create these feasts on a nightly basis, and you know, thinking about her life and their life as a family at that time, you know, what she produced was extraordinary. But then coming to, you know, to New York, following, you know, his eldest brother Charles Pollock, Charles also introduced him to his painting teacher Thomas Hart Benton, whose wife Rita was a great chef or cook, I suppose you'd say, not technically a chef, but a Northern Italian woman who was passionate about feeding people and nurturing them. She was very vivacious, and that's where he had his first spaghetti as an 18-year-old.
You know, you call East Hampton or Springs, you know, a hamlet of a city out there in you know, Long Island, but really it was almost so theatrical because of the characters that were there, you know, from other artists, you know, to friends that were painters and mentors, Hans Nemeth, and I mean, there was such culture happening around, and everyone kind of threw that into the mix when we're talking about recipes and food as well.
Yes, it is a fascinating place for that reason, and I think that's the reason it still attracts a lot of artists today. And it's, you know, I don't think I've ever been anywhere in the world that's like that you get this, you know, incredible combination of extraordinary ingredients. You know, this wealth of culture, you know, the museums, the private galleries, you know, you've got the Parish, you've got, you know, youngsters like Tripoli Patterson in Southampton with his galleries. You've got, you know, these fantastic, dynamic, creative environments and communities. And you know, they had that out there in the 40s and 50s. And there was a lot of recipe swapping, a lot of ingredient swapping, a lot of obsession with their own gardens and what they were producing, fishing, clamming, you know, it was a way of life. And even though we think of it now, I think, as a sort of a, you know, think of the drama of these characters, one of the things I learnt in the project was there was a lot of just everyday dynamic going on, you know. Hey, I've got some eggplants. Oh, look at this fish. Let's go out and do this together, or have you over for dinner. You know, there was a lot of that. But in the, I suppose when we look back at these things, it all just seems so marvelous, doesn't it? And so extraordinary.
Well, I mean, take the eggplant, for example. Who else slaps an eggplant and says, this is color?
Yes.
You know, I'm quoting from one of the head notes of the recipe, I think, eggplant Constantinople.
Yes.
But, you know, that Pollock was obsessed with just the color, the hue, the tone of the eggplant itself, as yes. well as the fact that he had grew it.
Exactly. And I think the landscapes as well, you know, Lee Krasner talked about how passionate he was about the landscapes out there. And as an Australian going in there, in a sense, possibly in a similar way, you know, he came from the West where he didn't see snow on a beach. You know, he didn't see some of the colours and landscapes. And then into this environment in Springs and the surrounding landscapes, they're very diverse. You know, you get those beautiful sweeping white beaches of East Hampton, and then you get the tiny little bubbling creeks just behind their house. You get, you know, these forests where they would forage for wild ingredients. And then you get, you know, these kind of stark beaches around Louse Point where they did a lot of their fishing and clamming, beach picnics. So it's a fascinating array of visual stimulation and opportunity, I think, for an artist. And I think it's very much still like that today.
I mean, reflected in the work. No wonder there are painting titles like Enchanted Forest and Sounds in the Grass. I mean, it was all around him.
Exactly. The Accabonic Creek series was one of the first series he produced there. And Accabonic Creek was directly at the base of their property and is an ever-changing tidal creek, which sometimes is smelly and muddy and horrible, and other times is just like this sort of beautiful oasis of calm with all the marshland grasses around. It's a very changing visual experience being there at different times of the day even. So you can see how stimulating that was, not just to go and clam there, but just to be in that environment. And, you know, the work reflects that.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to do a little more fishing, foraging with Jackson Pollock via Robin Lee. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point of origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, my name is Chris Kuzmi from Men About It. My favorite food is liquid bread, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here again today with Robin Lee of Dinner with Pollock. Jackson Pollock, that is. Like, I kept on writing Pollock as if he were a fish when I was putting my notes down. I'm like, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
That's a blending food with art there. Your introduction to Jackson Pollock's cuisine or his food, his recipes, was through cornmeal, something that you weren't even familiar with as an Australian. Tell me about that recipe and, you know, that flavor profile.
Mm. Well, I mean, as an Australian coming over here, there were quite a few recipes that I'd never tried before. And one of them was what we call in the book cross-country Johnny cakes, which they love to cook up and sort of drizzle in, you know, maple syrup, butter, a side of bacon or whatever. And Jackson and his eldest brother Charles lived on Johnny cakes as they crossed the country from New York to California to visit their mother. And they basically would they bought a huge sack of this, you know, cornmeal and would make up the Johnny cakes along the way and then just whatever they could afford to buy, you know, that was readily available and cheap, they would sort of tack onto their meals. But I think it's a beautiful recipe because to me it helped me understand the story of the two brothers. You know, Jackson didn't come from a vacuum, and I think unfortunately and historically people sort of think of him as almost coming out of nowhere, that, you know, perhaps his family wasn't particularly interesting. But in fact, one of the things that became very, very clear was his family were a fascinating, industrious, hardworking, talented group of people who were extremely open-minded for that time and gave these boys opportunities that, you know, would have been unheard of, I think, in this day if you had five boys living out in the West with no money. Like, you wouldn't encourage them to be artists. I can't think of many people who would do that. And, you know, here were these parents who were supporting that, who lived on the land. His father was a farmer. And, you know, you see the influence of the eldest brother, Charles, and what he brought to the younger brothers in terms of, you know, the creative influence, but also in terms of The support and bringing Jackson to, encouraging him to come to New York, introducing him to the right people who then introduced him to all of these new culinary experiences, but a real dynamic and exchange. Now, one of the things that I'm excited to see is that the Peggy Guggenheim collection in Venice is about to open a major retrospective of Charles Pollock's work. And I know this is completely off topic, it's not food related, but it shows, it will show Jackson's work and Charles's side by side for the first time. And, you know, they shared a lot together. And I'm really glad that that will be happening.
No, I mean, seeing all these recipes side by too, what Stella, you know, gave to the family and how other people interjected, it's fun to see, you know, Jackson Pollock's interpretation of these outside influences and, you know, a stimuli. Baking bread, both apple pies, he became obsessed in this way that he actually had award-winning apple pies. Tell me about this recipe.
So his apple pie became very famous in Springs because it won first prize at the local Fisherman's Fair at Ashwa Hall. And by the following year, people were already bidding ahead of time to see if they could buy the special pie. His mother was a great baker. She had actually over almost 100 recipes, dessert recipes, and, you know, countless other bread recipes in her book. And I think he really learnt that and was influenced by her passion for baking. And so he really was, it was very defined in their kitchen. So he was the baker. Lee was sort of more a general kind of cook. And, the apple pie was kind of symbolic, I think, of his passion for baking. He did breads, he did pancakes, he loved anything that was really around those baking recipes. And I think one of the surprises of the project was that that was the case. And people are, you know, surprised when they hear it because we think of Jackson as being this wild man, and yet even in recent studies of his work, they've seen that actually there was an absolute methodical approach to the canvas, and that there was almost like a sort of an underpainting of structure that showed and supported his own quotes. In his lifetime, he said, you know, he denies the accident. And that, you know, for him, there was very much an approach that was not a wild flicking of paint, but he knew exactly where it would land. And I think this, when you think about it in that way, the baking makes a lot of sense because to me, it's an art of precision. It's almost a science.
Yeah, and patience. But in that patience, it's because you have a foundation. You have those technical skills already so that you can actually begin to be creative. Yes. So it just seems like, you know, baking fit into his mode of thought because, you know, you can get this core structure of something down and then you can start tweaking and tweaking and playing and playing. But there's nothing more basic than a beautiful apple pie. So yes, once he could master that, then he could, you know, expand his repertoire.
Exactly.
Stella's potato pancakes. You know, we come back to this idea of Pollock's family not being the wealthiest, but being very industrious and very smart with what they have. Long Island's bumper crop of potatoes is legendary. You know, people overwinter those and they go throughout the whole year. So it's just fun to see that, you know, she not only understood that aspect of it, but read MSK Fisher and, you know, interjected these renowned food writers into her very standard recipes.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, some of the recipe books in their collection I think are very telling. They had the James Beard, fish cookery book. They had several books that were given to them by friends around themes of nutrition, you know, what to put into your body, smoothies, you know, almost like juice fast type recipes.
Like raw food diet.
Yes.
I mean, so
yes,
ahead of the curve. It's kind of amazing.
And I think, you know, this came from the belief that one of their advisors instilled in them too, that Jackson's alcoholism could be cured through food. And I think it's a very poignant story that, you know, they did try very hard to cure his alcoholism. And one person, Mark Grant, his name was, gave them the impression that if they followed religiously a diet that he gave them, which, you know, and also had these regular protein drinks and salt baths, that he would be cured. And we know today, of course, you can't cure alcoholism through a strict diet, but you can see how hard they tried to do that. And, you know, Lee was really supportive of that. And I think it's very sad. But, you know, finding the lists of those ingredients, you know, pinned to the front of one of their recipe books was one of those moments that I thought, you know, here's a human being just trying his best. You know, we know the wild stories about them, but I don't know that it's commonly known that, you know, there was this attempt to really get himself together and several attempts over a long period of time.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously he celebrated life. And I'm not just talking about the drinking aspect, but, you know, beach picnics with, who was it, Lucia Wilcox. So there was a very, you know, much more humanistic side than I think we all see as this madman painter artist type. I mean, he was a very serene person, and he just kept on trying to have that serenity now, and it really shows itself in this book and these recipes.
Yes, and he was very joyous. You know, he was almost childlike, I think, in his enthusiasm for ingredients. John and Josephine Little's daughter, Abigail, wrote this lovely long letter to me during my research phase, remembering when Jackson burst in through their kitchen door with the first fresh strawberries from Amagansett and his enthusiasm and passion for these ingredients and his embarrassment that he couldn't afford to buy more for them. So, you know, there's beautiful stories about, you know, love of nature and ingredients and a real respect for that.
Let's talk about July 3rd, because this is great that people can actually participate in this love of not only Jackson Pollock, but, you know, the land in which he held so dear. You're actually doing a brunch at the Pollock Krasner House and Study Center in East Hampton.
Actually, it's not there. It's at Art Hamptons.
At Art Hamptons.
As part of the Art Hamptons event. They're hosting this gorgeous luncheon, you know, with the recipes from the book, and the proceeds will go to Pollock House. It's going to be a real celebration of those recipes using the local ingredients, which I think is fantastic. And a local chef there, Chef Colette, will be preparing that meal, and there'll be a signed book for everyone. So it'll be a special day, and we hope you can come.
Yeah, and another place that, you know, this book and you yourself are traveling, which is really cool. It's the U.S. Pavilion in Milan. You know, you get to go back to Milan, but you're bringing Chef Mark Ladner with you to create a large spread of Jackson Pollock delights.
Yes, so, you know, the U.S. Pavilion is also sort of, I suppose, partnering with the James Beard Foundation, and they're creating this beautiful pop-up restaurant in central Milan in a historic building, where they'll be hosting a series of food events. And the first official event of the program will be this this event with the recipes, and Mark Ladner has been invited by the U.S. Pavilion to come over and interpret those recipes. So I was lucky enough to spend some time with Mark, showing him around, you know, some of Jackson's favorite, you know, fishing places and clamming places, and his house and studio recently in Springs.
I only hope Long Island clam pie makes it to Milan.
I hope it does too, because I loved it.
Yeah.
I don't love shellfish, but I loved that.
Or maybe some meatloaf and mustard, but that's more of Stella's repertoire.
Yes, exactly.
As you can tell, I'm already obsessed with this book. It's not only a fantastic portrait of, you know, an artist, but someone who really taught themselves about the world and you know, mediums through food and the land that, you know, they can forage and farm and fish from. So it's so endearing. And if you need to see that softer side of Pollock, it's certainly in this book. It's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you.
So go out and buy Dinner with Jackson Pollock, Recipes, Art and Nature. Just came out by Ozzeline. Thank you, Robin Lee, so much for being on the show. And stop by, you know, Art Hamptons or Milan. She'll be cooking up a storm there.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.